KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
What would happen if we did not dial back the heat-trapping pollution would be unthinkable. And we have to avoid it. The world has to avoid it. And the United States is still the only nation that can lead the world. These storms, it's like a nature hike through the Book of Revelation on the news every day now, and people are connecting the dots. The public is lulled into an acceptance of going along with this policy of using the atmosphere as an open sewer. That's what we're doing.
Vice President, former Vice President Al Gore, looking at the climate. He's been delving into the future. He's written The Future, Six Drivers of Global Change. In it, he takes an in-depth look at the major shifts in the world. We're going to take that up. Thank you for being here.
No, it's great to be back. Thank you.
So all sorts of things to talk about. But let me start with a couple of things to get in. We'll just dive into the book here. What is Earth, Inc.?
It's an emergent global interconnected economy that is different qualitatively and not just quantitatively from the growing interconnections that have linked businesses and industries around the world. It now has a holistic integrity of its own that gives it a different relationship to national governments, regional governments, labor, capital, resources. Every business now has to operate inside Earth, Inc., and employee jobs are both outsourced and robo-sourced, and we're seeing a new level of advanced automation that's extremely different from what the economists are used to describing when they use the phrase Luddite fallacy. It's no longer clear that the pattern in history will hold, that is, new technologies create more jobs than they displace.
I want to come back to robo-sourcing. What's the global mind?
Again, an emergent new reality. Emergence itself is a concept that takes up a lot of the introduction to this book. But billions of people are now connected, their thoughts and feelings shared instantaneously across national boundaries. And they're connected at the speed of light, not only to one another, but to an increasing array of intelligent devices and sensors being embedded ubiquitously throughout the physical world, databases that contain a significant fraction of all the information ever created in the world. And it's changing the way we think, the way we organize society, the way we do business, and the flows of information between machines with no people involved over the internet is now many times larger than the flows among people, and the growth rate in that category far exceeds the connections among people.
And you wrote this a little into the book. The combination of Earth, Inc. and the global mind now provides elites with an enhanced ability to manufacture consent for political decisions, serve their interests rather than the public interest, provides corporations with an enhanced ability to manufacture wants in order to increase consumption of commodities, manufactured products, all doing it with without the need for anywhere near as many workers. We're going to have a world where the elites can operate without the need for working people or as many working people.
Well, the trends are pointing in that direction. One of the main themes in this book is that we as human beings, and especially we as Americans, have an obligation to participate in making choices that can affect the way this future unfolds. But let me stick with your main point for just a moment. Since the early part of the 20th century, really in the 1920s, we have had a consumer demand-driven economy. And indeed, the role of advertising and the manufacturing of wants is now central to the operations of the economy. At the same time, the middle class has been earning wages and salaries at a level that empowers them to go to the stores and buy goods and services, keep the pump primed, and fuel this virtuous circle of a demand-driven economy. But the middle class has been hollowed out. It's shrinking. And part of the reason is the combination of outsourcing and robo-sourcing.
You should describe that, robo-sourcing. Define it.
Well, advanced automation is different from what the Luddites worried about hundreds of years ago, because now what's being extended and magnified is not just our physical capacities to work, but our cognitive functions. One quick example to illustrate it. Some law firms are now using a new algorithm that empowers one first-year lawyer to do as much legal research as used to require 500 first-year lawyers.
500.
And the number of mistakes in that research falls way, way down. Now, those other 499 lawyers, we would think in the past, are going to find jobs in these new emergent fields that are being created by the new technology itself. And that's no longer clear. We have lots of work to do, but much of what needs to be done and compensated for today is in the category of public goods. We need more mental health care. We need environmental remediation. We need much more intelligent and more investment in public education, etc. And we have had an ideological hegemon that has driven us to pull functions from the public sector into private markets, but this at a time when the income flows for middle-class Americans is shrinking. And by the way, this is true not only in the U.S. and Europe and Japan, but also in China and India and other developing and emerging economies. Foxconn in China, that makes so many of the smartphones, just announced that it's installing over the next 3 years 1 million new robots. So these rural Chinese men and women that came to the Guangzhou area and other manufacturing centers are now going to have to compete with these intelligent machines.
Isn't that even what's happening with Apple? Apple announced they're going to manufacture back here, but aren't they doing robots?
Yes, that's right. Now, the half-full part of that glass is we are seeing here in the U.S. manufacturing jobs coming back, and the president spoke about this the other night. The half-empty side of that glass is that there are not nearly as many jobs associated with it. You walk into these factories now, and you don't see very many people. It's just a constant low hum of all these robots and machines.
Well, do we have the jobs of making robots, or are robots going to be making robots as well?
They will be, in fact.
Al Gore is author of The Future, Six Drivers of Global Change, former vice president, won an Academy Award for An Inconvenient Truth, has been very successful in high-tech and communications investments, does long-term investments with his company. That's why it seems that there is a dystopian future before us, which is a future that has many millions of people without means and a few millions of, or even billions of people who have what they need through this system.
It doesn't have to be dystopian. We still have not only free will, but the powers of free people to make decisions and implement them through our self-government. But we need to restore the functioning of our government. Our democracy has been hacked just at the time when we are confronting these incredibly difficult and challenging decisions. So, as I said before, there is no shortage of work that needs to be done. But building the new models for compensating people to do the things that are absolutely essential now, that is a challenge.
What does it look like to you, that new model? And how is the money, or the wealth, let's call it, that is going to a smaller and smaller group of elites, how does that money be let go of in a way that everybody would accept? I mean, we're all in it together, responsibility, but what's the model? What's the lever that makes it happen?
Well, I don't think there's a single silver bullet. I think there's some silver buckshot, lots of different solutions, like co-op models. I think also we're seeing a return to a more local-centric economy. where people are trying to source materials, food, crafts in the areas in which they live. We have some mind-blowing new technologies like 3D printing, which is likely to have an impact on manufacturing that is comparable to what mass production and interchangeable parts had in the early part of the 20th century. And this model is also a local-centric model. We are also going to have to, in my opinion, we're going to have to change the way we measure progress, the way we define growth, the way we include in our calculations the things positive and negative that we now call externalities. Pollution is a negative externality. The benefits of education and investments in music and art and culture and science and R&D are positive externalities. We need to become much more precise and inclusive in deciding what kind of future we want to create.
But what gets us there? Well, I understand there's not one, but there have to be. I mean, I see the you write about it in the book, education, health models, internet and democracy. These are all things we need to reform or rework. But what are the, you know, we are up against an idea that opposes that, that doesn't see that as the model at all.
Yeah, I think it's beginning to give way. I don't want to fall back on the old cliche, it's always darkest before the dawn, but I think that it's significant that the recent polls show an historic reversal for the first time in many decades in attitudes about what the size and functions of government should be. We need to reform government, but we need to use the empowering technology of the internet, the global mind, if you will, to make much better decisions. Right now, elites are in control to an unhealthy degree, in part because money has enabled the wealthy and powerful to hack democracy and to make it operate in ways that our founders did not intend. But the internet is already beginning to change this. Young people are more active in their communities than any previous generation, partly because of the internet. Individual bloggers now affect the course of important debates. And while the television age, which is a centralizing, suffocating force where democracy is concerned, the internet, the television age is still dominant, that will not last for much longer. The internet culture is growing. It is empowering individuals to connect with one another. Business models are being disrupted. Cultural and societal models are being disrupted. And in the main, what is replacing these old models are more efficient, more humane, more precise, and more productive new models.
So where do you see that? Where do you see the replacement that are more humane? Do you have any examples? You start with healthcare if you want.
Yeah, we're seeing the leading edge of a revolution in healthcare called precision medicine. We're seeing what one author called the creative destruction of American medicine. And it comes with a combination of the global mind and all of these digitally connected devices that don't just allow us to communicate with our doctors, but allow our hearts and blood vessels and vital functions to report data securely to machines that the doctor is consulting. And that's one element. The other element is the decoding of the human genome, the microbiome, the assembly of an increasing volume of highly relevant, highly valuable medical information about each individual. We have had a model in healthcare that is the classic one-size-fits-all, broad-spectrum antibiotics, medicines that are tested on massive populations, and actually some people benefit and some people don't. But it's now increasingly possible to develop pharmaceuticals and procedures and therapies that are targeted and tailored precisely to the individuals that will benefit from the new approach.
Well, there's the possible. So now I want to take a break and come back and talk about the probable if I can. Al Gore is our guest. He is the author of a new book, Al Gore, The Future, Six Drivers of Global Change. You're listening to Weekday.
KUOW. It's 919.
Support for KUOW comes from Laird Norton Wealth Management, an independently owned wealth advisor committed to balancing clients' financial well-being with their personal fulfillment, providing customized financial planning, investment strategy, and trust management services. On the web at LairdNortonWM.com.
46 degrees with light rain in Seattle's University District. Expect rain at times this morning. Cloudy skies. Chance of rain this afternoon. Will have a high of 52 degrees.
Some communities cheer the closing of a nuclear plant, but a Florida community is mourning the loss of one. The power plant north of Tampa was also the area's economic engine.
I mean, things are already tough. If this makes it worse, don't know if I can hang in there.
The economics of closing down a nuclear facility today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Just one of the things you'll hear during our afternoon news magazine, 3 to 7 p.m. here on 94.9 KUOW.
Al Gore is our guest. He is the author of Al Gore, The Future, Six Drivers of Global Change. He's also done some investing the last few years. You can read about it. You've been successful. Generation Investment Management. Yeah. I was going to bring up the website, but it's messing with me. You have a whole part about sustainability.
Yeah.
And how sustainability can be an economic plus for people with a long-term vision.
Absolutely.
You talked about 3D printing. There's wind.
Yeah.
There's smart technologies, there's smart grids. But those often are the public investments you're talking about.
Mm.
How do you convince private investors? Do they need to have a partner in the public? How do you convince them that these are good ideas?
Well, that's one model. Public-private partnerships do have an important role to play, but the investment marketplace itself is in dire need of reform. That's one of the reasons why I co-founded and chaired Generation Investment Management. I co-founded it with my partner, David Blood, and I really did want to call it Blood and Gore.
Totally should have.
I thought so too, but the other partners wouldn't go along with it. But we are attempting to prove the business case that the full integration of sustainability into the traditional investment process can not only avoid losing money to uphold values, but can actually outperform. And I'm looking for wood to knock on here because future is always challenging for investors, but we've done extremely well for almost a decade now, outperforming markets every year. And what we've learned in the process is that we need sustainable capitalism. The normal organic process by which businesses build up real value takes time. The average business builds up 80% of its value over a business cycle and a half, say 7-8 years. But while that used to be the average holding period for stocks 30 years ago, now the average holding period is less than 6 years. And 60% of the trades in New York and London are now by supercomputers with high-frequency, high-speed trading in milliseconds. And this is putting pressure on CEOs and managers to focus on the extreme short term. One study by a leading research firm, BNA, found they asked a series of questions to CEOs, CFOs. One of them was this: here's an investment that'll make your company more profitable, stronger, more sustainable, but if you make it, you will slightly miss your next quarterly earnings projection. Given those terms, will you make the investment? 80% said no. And that's functionally insane. It hurts the economy, it hurts shareholders, it hurts employees, and it deprives all of us from the long-term value creation that capitalism is geared to provide.
Well, so does evidence convince them to make their changes, or is there a need to change the structures?
There is a need to change the structures. We have a lot of inertia in all of our human systems. I'll give you an illustrative example here. Pension funds, which are so huge in the investment marketplace, they are a classic example of investors who have a fiduciary duty to match the performance of their assets to the long-term maturation of their liabilities. They all know how many people are going to retire 10 years, 20 years, 30 years from now. And yet, because of the culture, they almost all turn over the day-to-day decision-making on the management of their assets to managers who they compensate on a quarterly basis or on an annual basis. And so if the people who are making the decisions are personally financially rewarded for short-term performance, that's what they're going to seek. But, you know, the old QWERTY problem with the typewriter keyboard, things are sticky. It takes time to shift cultures. But this is an urgent challenge. And when I say democracy and capitalism have been hacked, this is only one example of how capitalism has been hacked. Misaligned incentives, short-term decision-making. Let me give you another one real quickly. We have an obsession with growth as the holy grail for every nation's economic policy and every company's business plan. But we don't even stop to think about what we mean by growth. The definition that really drives decision-making was arrived at in the 1930s. A guy named Simon Kuznets was justly honored for creating GDP, gross domestic product, and the business accounting systems are all derived from that. But he said in 1937, please do not use this as a guide for your economic policies.
Well, do you think that business schools are where, for example, are where you can make the shift to bring in other values into these equations, the externalities we talked about? Because otherwise, we still run up against, I understand that I should be doing X, but you know, Y is in front of me and it's a lot easier.
I think that business schools are clearly one of the places.
I mean, is it a value question that you're talking about?
Yeah, it's a consciousness question ultimately, and it's rooted in values, yes. But of course, we're vulnerable as human beings to just keeping on keeping on the same way we always have. And it takes an urgent need to actually change the way we think. But last night I was at Dominican University down in Northern California, and they have a green MBA program. And there are a number of other business schools that are now doing this. But here's the main way it's going to change. If companies like Generation Investment Management, and thankfully there are some others following our lead now, if we can continue to outperform the market, then that puts market pressure on other investors to change the way they do things. But governments can also play a role. We need an alternative to GDP. We need to internalize these externalities. And it's not only the externalities and depletion of resources that's left out of GDP, it's also the distribution of income. And this is not a redistributionist proposal, but it is a proposal for looking at the consequences of what our policies produce.
But you think if that information was, we have a public health professor here, does great work, and he's argued that instead of GDP, instead of reporting the stock numbers every morning, he said, why don't you report numbers of people who are unemployed, number of people who applied for food stamps. All right, so let's say that becomes the meme by which we determine the economy's fate in any given time. Why will that change the choices that we're making?
Well, I think it could make a difference, and I do support that. But we also are faced with data overload, and that's one of the reasons why we always choose these heuristics or shortcuts. And GDP is an example of a shortcut that makes it seem as if we don't have to think deeply or carefully about what we're actually trying to achieve. But, you know, since the Great Recession ended in 2009, we've been struggling to escape the recessionary forces. But since then, 93% of all of the new national income in the U.S. has gone to the top 1%. And that's counted as a big win for the economy. Yay, we got growth. But actually, it's not. It doesn't feel like a win for middle-income Americans. And for decades now, the fate of the middle class has been stagnant wages, increasing expenses, and the incomes have shifted disproportionately in the extreme to the very top brackets.
Al Gore is author of The Future, Six Drivers of a Global Change. All right, so let me shift to democracy and media, and let's go into the murky waters of it's hard to be a saint in the city, is what I was talking about with the boss there. Now, Current and Al Jazeera, I've heard all the explanations people get raised and the criticism you got and your responses, understanding the criticism. What I want to know is your thinking about this.
Sure.
Current, was how many outlets were there for Current? Where was Current carried on? How many cable channels?
We had...
We had
about 50 million homes, and we ended up with about, in the transaction, one of the distributors canceled out. So we transferred to Al Jazeera 40 million homes.
All right, so you must have weighed the cost-benefit analysis of making this choice, knowing you're going to be hit with criticism of bringing in the oil sheikhdom and being hit with hypocrisy. Did you think that you were offering a disruptive lever by bringing Al Jazeera into America?
Absolutely. And yes, I knew full well that I'd be answering questions about this. I had a book tour coming up. I knew full well and that there would be criticism. But after doing diligence on the network itself, Al Jazeera English was named Network of the Year in the United Kingdom last year. Hillary Clinton said it's part of the solution, not part of the problem. They have real news, not like our networks. I'm semi-quoting her, and a lot of other people say the same thing. It's won all these major awards, and more importantly than that, it has based its future on maintaining and building a reputation for objectivity and integrity. Now, here in the U.S., our television news environment has been degraded continually over time. You know the example of last year, 2012, the hottest year, Superstorm Sandy, 60% of the country in drought, $110 billion of climate-related disaster damage, West Nile virus, biggest outbreak ever, all the fires in the West, and not one single journalist asked a single candidate any questions in any of the debates about climate. That's pathetic. And it's also emblematic of how we get local crime news basically scaled up for national consumption, because if it bleeds, it leads. You know, the old, if it thinks, it stinks. The old meme in television news. And the line between news and entertainment has been so blurred that, I mean, I turned on a national morning news show the other morning looking for news about something that had happened that I was really interested in. And they had a long story on some poor guy who's been hiccuping for 65 weeks. And it was interesting. It was really interesting. You know, he has trouble getting a date. But it's just taken over.
But we have choices. Al Jazeera, I could still read Al Jazeera, and I could even watch Al Jazeera through the global mind.
Well, and those who have watched Al Jazeera English on the internet come away generally raving about it. But as a practical matter, television, satellite and cable television are still completely dominant. And so now people will have another choice, more diversity, a 24/7 intelligent, committed news gathering channel that has an international news. Remember that? We used to get it. And climate news. They do an outstanding job of reporting climate. Nobody else does here in the U.S. So I think it can be a very positive addition to the television dial. But hey, people can judge for themselves. It'll be on shortly.
All right. Well, so you're getting grief. You can make money on this, but you didn't have to do this to make money. You have money anyways. You have some money.
And they're going to keep most of our employees too. And that was also a factor.
What impact do they have on Fox News, on CNN, on NBC? I mean, what do you really think they do?
My hope is that they will raise the level of professionalism and commitment to news gathering. I mentioned before that line between news and entertainment has been blurred. Look at this thing. So last night on CNN, they have this. They have the logo 9 days of terror with the rogue cop down in L.A. And it's one hell of a story. Hell yes, it's news, but its own logo and its own, you know, it's just that we get these serial obsessions that just take over. And then so the charred body, they have an interest in people tuning in to keep that serial obsession going.
But what does that do to the voter? Do you really think
it
corrupts
deprives
us?
The voter of a serious exploration of the kinds of subjects I write about in this book, the kinds of choices that we as a free people need to make. If we're watching the continued, the 11th week of a search for a missing young woman in Aruba, I'm not saying it's not news. It is news. But if that crowds out any discussion of the fact that we're destroying the future of human civilization by putting 90 million tons of global warming pollution into the atmosphere as if it's a sewer every single day, that's not a good result.
Who holds Al Jazeera accountable as they enter the U.S. market? Because if it's as powerful as we think it is, it could get corrupted as well.
I don't think so, but we'll see. It will add diversity to a competitive group of conglomerate channels. One of the problems we had with Current, my partner Joel Hyde and I, was that we were the only independent in an age of conglomerates. And it's a consumer-facing business, so you really have to advertise to get viewers. And the conglomerate channels, they get free advertising on all of their sister channels all across the dial. We had to pay premium dollar for every ad we put up that wasn't on our own network. And as a result, without corporate deep pockets, we were profitable every year, but it was getting to the point where we really had to make a move. And the other options were not nearly as good.
All right. So so you took the money from an oil-based economy. You flew here. We drove here. Half of the stuff in this room was manufactured using chemicals and chemical processes.
Yeah.
We are all in a sticky morass that it's very difficult for us to get out of to make a change in the economy, to make a change in the climate. I come back again to the question of levers, capitalist levers, market-driven levers.
Yeah.
You talk about the carbon tax, cap and trade.
Yeah.
California just is again trying to start its cap and trade program. But these are easily diverted and corrupted tools. What's a mechanism by which they are brought back on course?
Yeah. Well, I flew in on United Airlines a little bit after midnight last night. And if there was a carbon tax or an indirect price on carbon through cap and trade, you would see economic forces driving much higher levels of efficiency in every form of transportation and in every walk of life. Earth, Inc. now relies on carbon-based fuels for 85% of the energy that's used in the world every day. At the same time, the Earth gets more energy from the sun in 1 hour than is required to fund to fuel the entire global economy for a full year. Now, here's the good news. In 2010, for the first time in history, global investments in renewable energy exceeded global investments in fossil fuel energy. This past week, it was announced that the biggest new source of electricity generation last year in the U.S. was wind. Australia announced electricity from wind is now cheaper than from coal and from gas. The cost of these alternatives is coming down rapidly. If we put a price on carbon, then we drive that shift dramatically. We speed it up. We accelerate it. It's happening. It's going to happen.
You do think so?
Oh, absolutely.
BC has a carbon tax, but there's a lot of pushback against it. One of the things BC did was say, look, we're putting on a carbon tax, but we're also going to give you lower taxes in other places or rebates.
I support. I mean, we're going to need new revenue for the long-term debt problem, but it's tough enough to get a carbon tax, so it should be revenue neutral. And not only BC, but also Quebec on the other side of the country. And Australia, the biggest coal exporter in the world, has just imposed both a CO2 tax and cap and trade. China has put cap and trade in two cities and five provinces as a pilot, which they declare will become a nationwide program in 2 years from now. I hope they follow through. India's put a coal tax on. South Korea's moving. Ireland, the EU's already there. I don't want to exaggerate the amount of this change that's undergoing, but here's why I'm so optimistic about it, Steve. The more solar and wind we use, the faster it comes down in price. The more coal and oil we use, the more it increases in price.
But we've just had a president who otherwise talked about climate change for the first time, also said we're going to open up more natural gas and oil drilling. He has to deal with the Keystone Pipeline. We've got Canada making all sorts of money. I mean, talk of peak oil, which you touch on here, talk of peak oil is sort of gone down for a while because new technologies, as the oil people said, new technologies are going to bring us more oil and gas for the near term, the near middle term.
Well, actually, conventional oil production on land masses peaked 30 years ago. And all of these new sources are significantly more expensive.
Well, they're going for them.
Well, they are going for them. There are a lot of weird factors underway with the gas fracking part of it. And they can't, you know, each new well needs 6 million gallons of water. The water is then poisoned. It's now causing all kind of problems in many places with pollution of the water tables. And the leaking methane and the flaring of methane is also a significant problem.
Well, again, it's the externalities question, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
But why isn't that? I would think that communities would worry about the loss of their water and have the political power to stop it, but
and
they
some
don't.
Do. And some do. You're seeing a huge revolt in places like New York State and even in Texas. There are counties in Texas that are on water restrictions for people and agriculture, opening up new fracking wells, which require millions of gallons of water to be diverted to them. That cannot continue. You know, a million cattle left Texas last year, and nobody expects them to return. 61% of our country was in drought. Much of it still is in drought. These fires in the West, 2 years ago, all but two of the 52 counties in Texas were on fire. And the governor there said, let's pray about it.
Exactly. Your good friends in Texas would say, look, we got gas instead of cattle, and so we'll turn up the air conditioners.
But increasingly, that's not what a lot of people are saying there.
So, do you think they have political power to make changes?
Yeah,
well?
I think
even
it's
with
changing.
Gerrymandered districts and state legislatures.
The gerrymandering thing is a problem for sure because it insulates extreme partisans who are mainly concerned about primary challenges from their more extreme brethren. And that is one of the problems that needs to be addressed. But the main problem that needs to be addressed in our political system is the dominant role of big money. Citizens United needs to be overturned. In this book, I write about the history of the legal reasoning that led to Citizens United. It's a part of a massive philosophical struggle since the beginning of our country. Now they can make anonymous contributions. And the dominance of television in the conversation of democracy has been largely responsible for the fact that these candidates and electeds running for re-election have to amass so much money to buy the TV ads that they spend the majority of every single day begging rich people, business lobbies, special interests for money. And that gives the whip hand to the special interests.
Well, has the web changed it? Has the net
changed
it?
It is beginning to.
So do you see a trend? Is the future then
Yes.
An alternative. Sorry, so
absolutely, and I'm optimistic about it. I mean, I see this as a...
I know you are. You tell me you're optimistic in here.
Well, you know, it's not Pollyannish. I mean, look, there are lots of examples of where values-based, morality-driven mass movements change history. The abolition movement, the anti-apartheid movement, the anti-colonialism movement in the 1960s, the gay rights movement today. That was thought to have been impossible. We're seeing the anti-whaling movement. You can go right down the list. And when more people connect the dots and realize that we are just pointing a dagger at the hearts of the next generation by dumping all this pollution into the atmosphere like it's an open sewer, it's not far-fetched to see this rising tide of public opinion. There are already 2 million new NGOs on the internet around the world organized on this issue.
What's your thought, from Inconvenient Truth to today, what's your thought about our short term? The next 15 years, because it's accelerated faster than even what you were talking about. We're in a critical window here, and we are, you know, the president said something about climate change today, or, you know, this State of the Union.
Yeah, I was really encouraged by what he, oh, yeah, absolutely. I met with him. I don't talk about my meetings with him, but I don't have any doubt that he's serious about pursuing this.
To the point where he should take on those executive actions
if
he doesn't get the law?
Yeah, he will. I think what you'll see, you know, decoding what he said in the State of the Union, and he was great in the inaugural address also. Yeah. You know, the EPA has the legal authority now, affirmed by the Supreme Court in 2007, to regulate global warming pollution. He's applied it to newly constructed power plants. Now, what's going to happen if the Congress doesn't act? And, of course, it won't, because the coal and oil people control them, pull their strings. They say jump, and the majority in Congress says
how high. Well, people say he's a coal guy.
Well, I think that he has – I think that he's made a commitment to act on climate. And what he can do, and I think will do, is impose these restrictions on global warming pollution from existing power plants, and he may use an allocation formula that won't be called cap and trade, but it's likely to be similar to it in order to accomplish that goal.
What does the private sector do? Like, what are you doing with the people who are your clients? Given that, what's your strategy? And feel free to give us all investment advice.
Well, I'm always cautious in doing that. We're a concentrated fund at Generation, we look at everything through a sustainability lens. We don't have any investments in oil and gas. When we started out years ago, almost a decade ago, we did have some investments in BP because the guy running it then, Lord Brown, was pretty impressive, I thought, we all thought. But then they had that refinery fire in Texas and the pipeline accident in Alaska, and we took a real hard look at their safety culture, and we got out of it. Now, those who didn't, here's a perfect example of externalities that are not measured that lead to bad consequences in markets. The people who were still invested in BP at the time of the Deepwater Horizon accident looked at all these numbers on the Bloomberg screens. They got their quarterly earnings and projections and all the numbers that are included, but they didn't have data that showed them that the safety culture had gone to hell in BP and that they were not paying attention to protecting the environment. We were lucky to have picked that up because we have a lens that through which we look at that all the time, and we saw those accidents that I referred to, and we got the hell out of it. But how many times do investors have to take a bath because the metrics that are directly relevant to what's going to happen to the stock are not included in the way we report reality?
I want to end this by asking a question about metrics, maybe. The president talks about the need for pre-K education.
Yeah.
And that is going to cost money. And you mentioned about, you know, we need new revenues, but maybe make these carbon issues neutral at this point. When you look at the generation, our generation,
yeah,
should we be asked to pay more now into the system, either higher Social Security costs, higher Medicare costs? Because every politician says we have to make changes, but we'll do it to the generation that, you know, doesn't yet exist. I mean, is it time, if we're really going to make changes, is it time for this generation to feel the financial pinch?
Well, there are really two ways I'd like to answer that question briefly. First of all, we are now in a macroeconomic situation where it is foolish in the near term to take demand out of the economy. We're still trying to achieve escape velocity to get out of the recessionary pull from what happened in 07, 08. And so that has to be a factor. But here's a second thing I'd like to say. Those who are in my income bracket, those who have benefited more from all the great things this country does, hell yes, we ought to be paying more.
But that wouldn't be enough, would it?
Well, it can help significantly.
Not unless it's Swedish levels of taxation.
Well, it can help significantly. But here's another point. Whether it's education or other challenges, we need to also adapt to the new opportunities that can make it more efficient without costing a heck of a lot more money. A lot of your listeners know about the Khan Academy. Sal Khan, it's all free. You go online, you Google K-A-H-N, and it's the first thing that comes up. That kind of model can be adapted to pre-K. It's already being adapted to university-level education. I'm an investor in a company called Coursera that gives the best college courses in the world free to everybody in the world. Now, these are revolutionary and disruptive changes of the kind that, when focused and implemented correctly, can bring vast improvements to our educational system.
All right, sir. I hope you come back.
Oh, I'd love to come back, Steve. I love your show, and thank you for reading the book. I wish I could tell you every single interviewer had, but thank you.
It's heavy. You said somebody asked you a question, and so you thought you'd answer it, and you did in a thick book. I appreciate it. Al Gore, The Future, Six Drivers of Global Change. There is an event tonight at 7:30 at Seattle First Baptist Church. It is sold out, so we gave you a little taste.
Thank you.
Maybe people will be there. Thank you, sir.
My pleasure.
This is Week 2.
Great interview. Thanks so much.
KUOW, it's 9:51.
Support for KUOW comes from the Seattle Symphony, presenting violinist Itzhak Perlman in a single-night recital on February 19th at Benaroya Hall. Ticket information online at seattlesymphony.org.
46 degrees and overcast in the University District. Expect rain at times during the morning. Cloudy skies, chance of rain this afternoon. We'll see a high today of about 52 degrees, a low tonight around 43.
Crowdfunding has been a very successful way to raise money for tech entrepreneurs, filmmakers, and now scientists.
I'm going to tell you about an exciting new project that we're working on. You buy them.
People say, you know, what can I do with $5,000? I'm an ecologist. You can do a lot of things for $5,000.
I'm Linda Wertheimer, funding science through the internet on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Join Bill Radke for that story and more tomorrow between 5 and 9 a.m. here on KUOW.
Support for KUOW comes from Hammer in Hand, dedicated to stewardship of the built environment through craft and science, collaborating with clients and architects on high-performance buildings and remodels throughout Seattle, from classic renovations to modernist passive house buildings. HammerinHand.com.
I'm Rob Wood. There's word that leading Senate Republicans may block confirmation of President Obama's nominee for Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel. We'll get the details in the headlines coming up at 10:01 on KUOW.
Art of Our City. Marcy Silman's here. George Balanchine was one of the country's most revered choreographers.
Yeah. But before I tell you about that, I'm going to tell you about the fact that Pacific Northwest Ballet went to New York City this week for the first time since 1996.
I was letting you get there.
Yeah, they took everybody. They took the orchestra. They took all the dancers. And last night, it's sort of the belly of the beast because George Balanchine, who ran New York City Ballet until his death in 1983, was the sort of king of choreography. He made it made ballet different than it had ever been before. And so PNB, they took to New York and they're last night performed three works by George Balanchine in the land that knows George Balanchine, and made me wonder, how do you recreate somebody's works 30 years after they're gone? And, you know, who was this guy anyway? And so I went to talk to a bunch of folks, including dance writer Sandy Kurtz.
George Balanchine changed the way we look at dance today, in the same way that Picasso changed the way we look at visual art, the same way that Mozart changed what we heard in the concert hall.
George Balanchine was born and trained in St. Petersburg, Russia, where he studied both music and classical ballet. He moved to Paris in 1924, several years after the Russian Revolution, and that's where Balanchine began to create ballets in earnest. He cemented his reputation as a dance maker a decade later, after he emigrated to the United States. Balanchine used the same steps and jumps as the choreographers that came before him. What made his work stand out was that he asked his dancers for more.
Higher, bigger, slower, faster, everything more, and no time to sit and think in a preparation. You're going to do a pirouette? Do a pirouette.
Francia Russell is the founding artistic director of Pacific Northwest Ballet. It's a job she shared with her husband, Kent Stoll, for more than 20 years. Russell knows Balanchine's dances firsthand. She joined his company, New York City Ballet, in 1956, and she danced there for 6 years. When she retired from dancing, Russell became the choreographer's ballet mistress. She helped to teach and rehearse Balanchine's work. And Russell's keeping his legacy alive half a century later.
Okay, so what we're going to do first is review everything you learned.
8 young women in sweaty leotards and tights listen intently as Russell talks them through the steps of Balanchine's 1941 ballet Concerto Barocco.
So let's start right from the beginning and do first and second movements, and then I think we stopped in the middle of the third movement.
Yeah, Russell doesn't work from videotape. When she needs to explain how Balanchine wanted a leg extended or an arm lifted, Russell demonstrates those movements herself. Seattle-based writer Sheila Farr has been researching dance preservation. Farr says this is the traditional way to teach dance.
Dance is the only performative art that wasn't generated in a written form. You know, a play was written first, its words. Music exists in a written form first. That's how it starts. But dance, that's not true. It very rarely is written as it's conceived or as it's created.
Choreographers may not write down their dances, but very often an assistant like Francia Russell does that work for them. She has a collection of notebooks that contain every Balanchine work she knows.
This is just written out. Glissade, grand jeté, with passe left to stage right in front of two girls. You know, it's
Russell thumbs through her Concerto Barocco notes. She performed in it more than 50 years ago.
I danced it, but then I just went in a room by myself and danced the whole thing and wrote it down.
Recording Balanchine's dances wasn't always that easy.
Some ballets I had to go around and pester dancers. They would see me coming and run because I was always asking questions. Show me what you did right here, you know, in the fortes. How did you end this variation? And, you know, if I got stuck.
Russell was 24 years old when George Balanchine first sent her out on her own to teach one of his dances. Since then, Francia Russell has become one of a cadre of experts who travel around the world to teach Balanchine's ballets. They're called stagers.
A stager is someone who should have all the information, including the choreographer's intentions, because just the steps without the intentions of the choreographer is rather meaningless. And then also be able to oversee the lighting, the costumes, the orchestra, be responsible for every aspect of the production.
Russell was the first person to stage Balanchine in his native Russia in 1988. She also taught dozens of Balanchine ballets at PNB during her tenure there. Russell and her fellow stagers are the main repository of the choreographer's artistic legacy. Balanchine didn't seem to care about the future of his dances, but Russell says he was a stickler when it came to faithful recreations.
If I had staged something and there was a little finger out of place, he knew it instantly, but he couldn't get up and dance it and show the dancers what the steps were, you know. But if anything was wrong, boy, he zeroed in on it.
The same way Russell now zeroes in gently on the dancers in front of her in the PNB studio.
Okay, nice heads. Chelsea, can you lift your cheekbone a little bit?
It's been 30 years since George Balanchine died, but Francia Russell still believes it's her responsibility to remount his dances the way he taught them to her.
So I feel it's important to pass on what he said, but I'm sure it's all filtered through my taste, my memories, my, you know, how fallible that is.
Francia Russell doesn't stage as many Balanchine dances as she did when she was younger. She hopes the people she's taught over the years will carry on her work. However faithful they may be to George Balanchine's legacy, those future performances will be filtered through the tastes and memories of a new generation. I'm Marcy Silman, KUOW News.
2, 3.
I'm Rob Wood. We'll have more of Weekday for you after the headlines. This is 94.9 KUOW, FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services. We're online at KUOW.org.
Support from Constant Contact.
46 degrees and overcast this morning in Seattle's University District. We'll have rain at times during the morning hours. Cloudy skies, chance of rain this afternoon. Expect a high of 52. It'll be mostly cloudy tonight. Expect some patchy.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.